I am so glad you could join us. I'm your host, Mo Gaudat. This podcast is nothing more than a conversation between two good friends sharing inspiring life stories and perhaps some nuggets of wisdom along the way. This is your invitation to slow down with us. Welcome to Slow Mo. My guest today is an ecologist and a philosopher who has dedicated his life to the management and protection of nature reserves. He's an expert in biology, Celtic linguistics, literature, comparative religious studies, and Eastern philosophies. This is a unique range of disciplines that has led him to advocate that a sustainable future for the community of all life beings is more important than just us humans. He comes from an understanding that the well-being of nature and the earth is inseparable from our own well-being. Matthias, thank you so much for being with me today.
Thank you very much.
I want to start with your story and how you ended up dedicating your life to fighting for the environment.
After I'd finished my master's study in biology in Holland, I embarked upon a PhD project in Ireland, studying peatlands, bogs, as they call them in Ireland. And they had been very poorly studied, and I was very enthusiastic about getting more and more information about these not so well-known peatlands. But while I was doing my research, they were simply being cut away from under my feet, because in Ireland, there were, at that stage, quite a big number of peat-fueled energy stations, because about 70% of Irish electricity was burned from peat. So at a large scale, bogs were disappearing. And so at a certain moment, I had to decide either to move on as quickly as possible to collect the data that I needed for my PhD, or to do something about their conservation, because at that stage, Ireland didn't have a very strong governmental conservation. There was only a small wildlife service within the government with very little funding. And moreover, Irish people felt that bogs were a nuisance, and that you simply should get rid of them as quickly as possible and burn them, and then you could use the land for agriculture. So the idea of peatland conservation is something that the Irish found very, very alien. So then I decided to, with a few friends and colleagues, to set up an organization for the conservation of Irish peatlands. And we worked for 10 years collecting funds internationally and lobbying, et cetera, et cetera. And we were quite successful in that sense that when we started, there were maybe a few thousand of hectares of bog conserved in Ireland. When we finished, about 250,000 hectares of bog had been conserved. And we were simply successful because we had no idea of how to conduct a campaign. We were amateurs.
Yes, exactly.
So we did things that no one else had thought of, and for some other reason, they were successful. But the most important thing that it brought me is that I realized that one can make a difference. We started with maybe three or four people in a small group, and slowly and gradually that became bigger and bigger. And after 10 years, a large number of Irish peatlands had been conserved as nature reserve. And that has always given me the feeling no one of us is without significance or without meaning. We can all make a difference in this world.
Which is what sort of led you to dedicate a life to that whole idea of preserving nature, of attempting to make that difference, to have that significance, if you want. But that's because of your background, your studies, your knowledge. Are you saying that any one of us can do this? Every one of us should do this?
Any one of us can make a difference. That's the major point I'm making. The reason that I embarked upon conserving nature is, I think, is the fact that I chose to start a campaign for conserving bogs instead of being a nice scientist and collect data before they were gone had to do with my childhood. I grew up in the countryside, in a house that was quite far away from a small village, surrounded by nature. And my whole childhood was spent outdoors. And for me, the plants and the animals that were living around the house where I lived were my companions in life.
Yeah.
I didn't see them as objects. For me, they were subjects. And I lived with them. And for me, it was natural that I would study biology because I had such a deep connection with nature. But then when I was in university, in Holland, scheme started which was basically intended to make farming more efficient, and it was rolled out across the entire country. And what was done by the government is that fields were enlarged, farms were made more efficient, wetlands were drained. It was basically a scheme to make farming more productive. But the result of it was that the whole landscape changed. And the landscape that I grew up in changed into an intensive agricultural landscape within 5 years. All the hedgerows were removed, all the wetlands were drained, all the forests were cut. And that shocked me. What really emerged at that moment is, who gives us the right to do this? For me, this was the landscape full of fellow creatures, which were by, let's say, governmental decree removed from their habitat. And that was the basis for all my conservation work later in life. It was also the reason why I then started to study philosophy and comparative religion, because biology didn't give me an answer on why. You see, biology explains how ecosystems work and what you should do to conserve them. But biology doesn't give an answer why people do what they do.
Why do people do what they do? Why? I mean, why would someone like you, is it because you grew up in relationship to nature? You grew up with nature. Others that didn't, maybe don't have the same mindset. I was watching a documentary yesterday about capitalism. Of all things, they were interviewing farmers that are farming on lands that used to be Amazon forest. So, you know, the Amazon forest gets cleared and they are on the edge of the forest. Their farms are literally bordering the forest. And the interview was shocking because the farmer was so passionately talking about how the government is wasting its resources to tell us to conserve this thing while they should actually put their efforts to help us make more profits. And he was completely convinced of what he was talking about. He wasn't shy to say it in front of the camera. His view is, look, economy matters, humans matter, money matters, and so why are you telling me to care for the forest? This is where it starts, but is this even fixable?
It is fixable, because ultimately, I think the way we treat the earth and the way we treat nature and the way in which we treat our fellow creatures is based on the image that we have of ourselves in this world. Ultimately, it all emerges from the simple question, who the hell do we think we are on this planet?
Oh, that's not a simple question. That is the biggest ego question that affects humanity at large. Who do we think we are?
Yes, yeah? And that is, I think, the basic question. And in this day and age in which we're talking about the Anthropocene, in which we humans are basically shaping the whole face of the Earth, that's the question that we urgently need to ask. Because the interesting thing is, environmental philosophy and also comparative religion shows us that that image of who we as humans think we are on this planet is different between cultures. Different cultures have developed different images, and in that way also shaped
absolutely
the way in which people in those civilizations treated the world and treated nature. And the problem is that we in the West have developed an image of ourselves as owners or rulers of nature. And that image is very old. It emerged in the classical period. It already starts with the great philosopher Aristotle, who made a hierarchy of natural things, starting with minerals and plants and animals and on the top humans, and then said that the lower rungs of this ladder were there to serve the highest. So there the idea emerged that nature was there for the purpose of the highest being, we humans. That was later translated by later thinkers into the idea that God created the world for us. And that was also taken on by Christianity.
Oh, yes.
And that eventually led even to the idea that in the 17th century, there was an English, quite famous scientist who wrote, God created cattle in order to keep beef fresh for human consumption.
Seriously? Just so that I eat fresh beef. Yeah, okay.
And that idea that nature is there for us has been part of Western worldview since the classical times.
But it's not all cultures. I mean, Islamic culture is different. Judaism, I think, is different. Shamanic religions or spirituality is all about we being part of nature, right?
Absolutely.
So this is maybe a little biased to our Western cultures, isn't it?
Yes, Judaism and Islam have the idea or have the worldview that we do not own nature. It's not there for us. It's owned by the creator and we need to take care of it.
Exactly.
And we may use it but never abuse it because we don't own it. That's the image of stewardship. And then tribal civilizations, but also the great civilizations of the East, like Hinduism and Buddhism and Taoism.
Absolutely.
They're the ideas that we are part of nature. We're not separate from the whole natural world. We are participating in nature, or we are partners of nature. So that's, again, a completely different worldview. And ultimately, your worldview shapes how you treat nature. What we've basically done in the Western world is the French philosopher Bruno Latour says what we've done, we completely objectified nature. We made it to a collection of things, of objects, without a mind, without a soul, without a spirit, and a collection that's there for us to colonize and use. That's its purpose.
Natural resources.
Exactly. We call it natural resources, and we call it also ecosystem functions. And basically, as some philosophers have claimed, we've taken the soul and the spirit out of nature and then basically disenchanted the world. And when the world is seen as a storehouse of objects for our use, in a limitless supply, then you simply keep on using it. And many thinkers feel that that's the basis of all the great crises that we have at the moment. The ecological crisis, decline of biodiversity, the climate crisis, but also the corona crisis that we have now. If we hadn't impacted upon nature the way we have and brought all kind of animal populations together that formerly were never together, and also brought ourselves into contact with all kinds of wild animal populations that we also put under stress, a pandemic like this would never have emerged. So the great crises of our day and age are basically rooted in this idea that nature's there for us as a commodity. And I feel that if we really want to move to a sustainable future, we need to reframe our ideas of ourselves and of the world. And we need to move to images, worldviews that you find in other civilizations, where nature is not seen as a collection of objects, but as a collection of subjects, of fellow creatures, fellow beings that also have a right to be here and with whom we develop relationships and partnerships. Beings that are not there for us, but that have their own rights and values. And that is a reframing of who you think you are in this world.
So we think we are the owner of everything. You're saying we're the partner.
Or partner, or participant.
A participant. Does that give us a responsibility or just gives us the duty of doing our part without impacting on the parts of others? Where is the line?
It gives us the duty to also look at the well-being of others. We do this in a normal social life. We do that with fellow human beings. We have what we call a social contract. If you have a certain interest and I have a certain interest, then we both need to look at our different interests. And then ultimately, we need to come to a solution where we, both of us, have some restraint in our demands. And that's what we call a social contract. That's how a society functions. But we don't do that with other than people persons. The Ojibwa Native Americans called animals other than people persons. And I like this idea.
Oh, I love that term.
And for us, we only have contracts with fellow human beings, but not with other than people persons. And I think that is crucial for a sustainable world, for our well-being on the physical level, but also on the emotional level. Because by making the world around us a world of objects to be used, we have made ourselves basically orphans in this world because we are part of nature. We emerge from nature. And I think what we need, and that's in line with your work, I think we need to move from the head to the heart because our whole body feels that we're part of nature. When someone walks into a forest, that has been shown by all kinds of scientific research. When you walk into nature, immediately your blood pressure lowers. The stress hormone cortisol is not produced as much anymore. You start to feel more vigorous, you start to feel more alert, and you start to feel happier there's a sense of well-being. Our whole system knows this.
Absolutely. Your parasympathetic nervous system engages because you're basically told nature itself is a signal not of a threat. It's actually a signal of I'm safe here and I can relax and I can focus on other bodily functions other than adrenaline and stress hormones and fight or flight that we have in our normal life every day. Yeah.
In a way, we know that it is home.
It really is home. Can I ask you a question? Because I definitely want to dive deep into what we should do. But you mentioned that our attitude towards nature is what cultivates the possibility of a virus like the coronavirus. But then the fact that the pandemic starts and that we are in a place where we're in lockdown, also almost it's undeniable that this has a positive impact on nature. So tell me a bit about your views on this. Is nature actively trying to lock us down?
I wouldn't put it like that, but what simply happens is if you look at the Earth as a global ecosystem, which we are part, we have become a part that has basically put an enormous stress on other parts of that system. And then it's only natural that those stressed parts react. And so what is happening is nature has been put under such stress that normal equilibriums are changing and that we now see viruses move to the human population where they formerly would not have done that because the population of animals that would have carried a certain virus would first of all not have been as close to us as they are now because we're continuously moving into their territory. And also we've put all these populations under stress. And when you're under stress, you get ill and you produce more viruses, et cetera, et cetera. So ultimately, it is a normal reaction, I would say, of a system in which one part is stressing other parts. And then the other parts react in a certain way. And that's not a conscious reaction, but it is a normal reaction of a system where there are interrelationships and interconnections that we don't see anymore and constantly break. And for nature, this is not very bad because I don't know whether you must have heard that young people in New Delhi now for the first time can see the Himalayas.
Yeah, I've seen the picture of that. It was sent to me on WhatsApp.
For decades, that was impossible. And rivers in Wuhan now are clean and there's fish swimming there that hasn't swum there for decades. And we see the same in the Netherlands. We see that when we look at air pollution, that's going down, we see that the nitrogen deposition from farming is decreasing. So nature, I think nature is quite happy at the moment. But something else is also happening, which I find extremely fascinating in all of this. In our semi-isolation, which we now have to live, there are two realizations that I see more and more with people. One is that we, as humanity, are a global community. This whole idea of nations and states and whatever, races and cultures, when push comes to shove, like now, we're one humanity. We're connected from Wuhan to where I sit now in Nijmegen or in Utrecht to New York. We are one community. And I think that becomes very palpable now. But another thing, what is also happening is that people are less active, can be less active in the outside world. So that leads to a certain introspection because you have to sit at home, et cetera, et cetera. And what in that smaller world I see happening with loads of people is that because wherever we live, there's always some nature. Even if you live within a city, there's always birds. There's always something that's alive outside. And people now connect much more with the natural world than they did before because they're less active in the outside world. They are almost in a sort of retreat and renew connections with the world. We have in Holland a national organization for bird protection, and they get about 1,000 new members every week because people now suddenly, sitting at home, make contact with the birds around their heads. So on the one hand, I think there is the connection on the larger scale that we feel we're part of one humanity. And on the smaller scale, we reconnect with the world around us, the world of other than people, persons, if I may put it that way.
Exactly.
Because suddenly we can see them and hear them and there, see how close they are.
Isn't it shocking with all of the work you've done over the years? You focused a lot on conservation and the idea of the coronavirus sort of grounding us basically is almost saying, let's conserve everything other than your homes. So stay in your homes for a while and everything else is now conserved. Now, the interesting thing is I come from the world of technology and I'm an engineer. So I look at life in terms of what machine can I build that can fix this? What in alternative energy or, you know, what electric car or whatever that is. But it seemed to me one of the biggest eye-openers with coronavirus is that if we just conserve, if we just stop hurting nature, it rebounds so quickly. Like in 2 months' time, you see the Himalayas, and in 2 months' time, you get turtles on the streets, and in 2 months' time, you get cleaner air, and so on and so forth. So that's not been discussed in terms of saving our planet, but it seems to be working. So is there a way for us to highlight? You know, you've worked with governments quite a lot. Is there a way to highlight that, to make that sort of mandatory? Can we sort of have like annual corona?
Can we have annual retreats?
Can we have annual retreats? Yeah.
I mean, the fascinating thing is we are basically in a large part of the world in retreat, meaning we have retreated, retracted from what we normally do in the outside world, all our activities and our whatever we want to build and create. And we now have time to reflect and experience. And the world around us is changing, but also the world inside is changing. What I feel is that in this crisis, we are forced to move more from the head, again, to the heart, to experiencing. And we have to, because we cannot go back where we were, and that's gone.
Oh, yeah.
That's history. That's just a thought. We have no idea what it will be in 2 or 3 months' time. That's just imagination. We have to live with the experience of this moment. And in the experience of this moment, I feel that people are, on a large scale, reconnecting with humanity. I mean, the fact that we suddenly realize that people working in healthcare and teachers, how crucial they are in our society. We now call them the vital professions. Until recently in the Netherlands, they were underpaid and not very much respected. They were just seen as something that had to be there, but not respected in society. Now, suddenly, we call them the vital professions, and we realize how a society works and what care is. And I find it very interesting that the people we do not talk very much about anymore at the moment are shareholders. For some other reason, they don't seem to play a big role in this reconnecting within society. But I also feel that we can reconnect with nature, because nature now is recovering in many places quite rapidly. And nature's even moving into cities. I don't know whether you've seen the pictures of animals that now feel safe to move into our world. And I think what it ultimately shows us, we need to build a partnership with nature. And that doesn't mean conserving nature in reserves, because that's what we usually do. We basically identify areas that we want to conserve, and they are so-called reserves. And that always reminds me of what we did with the Native American tribes. We put them into reserves. And outside, it's our world. And there we do whatever we want to do in terms of agriculture, etc., etc. I feel that, of course, nature should have domains where we don't disturb, where it can flourish the way it wants to flourish. But outside, we need to build partnerships, coalitions. I dream about greener cities, and I dream about agriculture that's in line with needs of nature. And that can only happen, I feel, when we rethink who we think we are, but not only rethink, because that's just a thought, but also feel it, experience it. I've conducted a lot of research in the Netherlands, but also in other European countries, on how people see themselves in relation to nature. What we see changing in at least European society, but I believe that also holds true for part of American society, that the old image that nature is there for us is changing. And that more and more, particularly young people, feel that we are partners of nature or participants of nature. One of the common images here in the Netherlands, two-thirds, up to three-quarters of our population feels that we are part of nature and should take good care of it. Now, that's fantastic. That's a change in image. But as long as that is just a rational cognition and not really experienced and felt, we simply maintain our behavior as a ruler. So I also feel what's quite crucial that we connect to nature again experientially, not just think that we're part of nature, but also feel that we're part of nature. And that's a change in relationships, in building relationships.
So I can do that. I have done that. And I think that one of the questions that will always come is, But what difference does it make? Like, if I'm going to be doing my part and aeroplanes are flying all over the world and factories are burning coal and a lot of young people who are very passionate about it are also losing hope a little bit. I think if you ask people, and you do actually ask your students, there is more and more pessimism that this is not within our hands anymore.
Yeah, again, but that's a thought. It's the thought that you're too small to change anything, or that the multinationals or the financial system or whatever, the economic system, ultimately will dictate what the world looks like, and that you as an individual can't do anything. And I believe this is a misperception, because what the natural world shows us, what nature shows us, what the world shows us, that we're all interconnected. No one and nothing exists independent of the world around them. We're part of a system, of, you could say, an ecosystem. We're part of a larger whole. We're not separate. That idea that we're separate from the world is in our heads. But at the moment that we sit here, I breathe oxygen that has been produced by trees. I've eaten food that has been produced by plants. We exist because nature exists. We're not independent. We think we are. So when you know and see and experience that you're part of a bigger world, that you're interconnected, that you inter-are, as the philosopher Thich Nhat Hanh says, we inter-are with the world, that simply means that you can not make a difference. Because you're part of the world, you're always making a difference in whatever you do, in whatever you say, whatever you act, but I also think in what you think, you are changing something in this world because you're part of that world. And then, of course, our next idea is immediately, and that's also a concept, oh, yes, but I'm very small and I'm only a tiny part, and et cetera, et cetera. But then you overlook that there's a myriad of connections of each and every one of us to the large world. And most of these connections we don't even see because we're so focused on what we want to achieve and what our daily work is. But through this myriad of connections on the world around us, often beyond our scope, and much more important than we ever could imagine. And the story I always tell, because that changed my life, is that I was at a conference and two young people, a young man and a young woman, walked up to me and they had a little boy with them. And I said, may we introduce our son to you? And I said, yeah, of course you may. And then they said, this is our son, Matthias. And my name is also Matthias. So I said, yeah, it's a nice name, isn't it? And they said, no, it has been named after you. So I, slightly worried, asked, do I know you? And they said, no, you don't know us.
What did I do?
Yeah, exactly.
Do I know you?
But 5 or 6 years ago, you were talking at some gathering, and they were present at that gathering, and what I talked about our relationship with the world, and I quoted to Buddha there, and I quoted a sermon that Buddha has given on loving kindness. And the central verse in that sermon is, may all beings be happy and secure, whether they're big, medium, or small, whether they're strong, medium, or weak, whether they're nearby or far away, whether they're seen or not seen, whether they're born or yet striving to be born, may all beings be happy and secure. Now, those two people had been present, and they'd just heard a few weeks before that they were pregnant. And they'd booked an appointment in a clinic 2 days after this meeting, after this gathering. And they were listening to this first, may all beings be happy and secure, born or yet striving to be born. And at that moment, they looked into each other's eyes, and without words, decided at that moment to let the child be born. And then 8 months later, a boy was born, and then they called the boy Matthias after me because they felt Buddha was too big a name.
Yes.
And they just wanted to share this. And that more really changed my life because I realized by simply choosing this verse, because I thought it was a nice verse, now read it, a person was born into this world that otherwise would not have been there.
Totally.
And I would never have known that if they'd not told me this. And then I suddenly realized that whatever we do in this world can have consequences far beyond what we can see. Because we're interconnected with this world. A word we say, a word we speak can change this world in the way that a being is born that otherwise would not have been there.
Absolutely.
And suddenly I realized that is what interbeing is, what connection is, what being part of a world is, what relationships are. We are not separate. We think we're separate.
Yeah.
But our body knows we're not.
And that one little action changes everything. Right? And by the way, you may have heard of this one, but there could be 1,000 others, little actions that you've taken that you may have never heard of that have completely changed the world. Other babies being born and other people living longer and accidents being avoided and forests living to give us air. And all of that, we never actually really measure. And I think the more interesting side of life is in all of those hidden,
absolutely
hidden impacts that we have every single day. One that is really interesting that I watch again on Corona is just by you not doing something, which is not being out there to pass the virus on, you're creating a wall, an invisible wall for the virus to propagate. So you may not have invented a cure, but literally one person staying at their home or taking the right precautions may end the pandemic, because that person would have been the one last person where the virus was going to jump from a current patient to them and then to two others and four others. And by you not being there, you would actually save the world without ever knowing it. And this idea of we're not nothing, we actually have an impact, is the biggest invitation there is, really.
Exactly. And, you know, I think it's also so joyful. We have thought ourselves, because that's simply a cognition, separate from the world. That's an idea, an image in our minds. And that has caused great suffering in the world for us, but also for nature. Whereas experiencing yourself as part of a global ecosystem, as part of a greater world, full of other than other humans, but also other than people persons, knowing that whatever you do impacts on the well-being of them and therefore on your own well-being, that's a joyful place to be.
Totally.
That is, I think, the deepest happiness that you can have. You're never alone.
You feel that you're part of the big community, not just your friends and family, not just your country, not just your ideology, but you're part of all being. I think this is what it's all about. I think this is an incredible place to end our conversation. The call to action for everyone to realize that there is a contract that needs to be signed, a social agreement, as you called it, with the other than people persons too, with the rest of nature. And I think the idea of signing that agreement may not lead you to become Matthias, who does work that can conserve nature at scale, but you will never know how far your own personal impact can go. I think that's the message. And if we, just by not doing what we've been doing for 2 months, can see the Himalayas and go back to seeing nature joining our cities, then perhaps we should consider not doing what we do every day. Maybe we should do a little less than what we do every day. And by doing that, we can together have that impact that changes the world. That's wonderful, Matthias. I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you so much for your wisdom and for all the work that you've been doing for all of us. It's been a pleasure to have you with me today.
And thank you very much for inviting me to this talk. And I was very happy to meet you, be it digitally. Thank you very much.
Exactly. Same here, as always. Thank you, Matthias. And for all of you who joined us, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to follow me on social media. Search for Mo Gaudet, Slow Mo, Soul for Happy, or 1 Billion Happy. I know you've got a lot going on, but remember, there is always time to slow down. Until next time, stay happy.